From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, UN observers caught in the violence in Syria, more conflict between North and South Sudan, and trying to restrict the pokies in Australia. The violence continues in Syria, even in the presence of UN monitors. In one northern Syrian town, at least 34 people died after government forces opened fire on protesters. And UN monitors, sent to Syria to try to encourage the government and rebels to comply with a shaky ceasefire, were themselves attacked. NPR's Kelly McEvers explains what happened.
It started with a funeral. A man who was killed by Syrian security forces over the weekend was about to be buried in the northern Syrian town of Khan Sheikhoun. The funeral was held in a part of town that claims to be free, meaning it's no longer under the control of the Syrian government. Instead, it's held by anti-government rebels who call themselves the Free Syrian Army. Still, the government's army and security forces maintain checkpoints in other parts of town. It was these checkpoints that reportedly drew the attention of the UN monitors. Under the UN peace plan, the government's soldiers and security forces are supposed to pull out of cities and towns. Residents of Khan Sheikhoun say UN monitors watched the funeral, which quickly turned into a protest against the government. Emboldened by the monitors, protesters and rebels shouted insults at government soldiers. Soldiers and security forces unleashed a barrage of gunfire. This video shows a tangle of bodies falling to the ground. Then the film goes blank. Activists in Khan Sheikhoun say the man who shot the video died. At some point, the UN monitors go back to their trucks. Then an explosion goes off and produces a huge cloud of white dust. The front of the lead UN truck is mangled by the explosion. Like so many things in Syria, there are two versions of this story. Residents say government security forces launched a grenade at the UN truck. The government says it was a bomb planted by what it calls terrorists. Either way, the blast and the shooting that preceded it killed dozens of people, many of them civilians. This video, uploaded to YouTube by Syrian activists, shows young men with gruesome gunshot wounds being brought to a makeshift field hospital. It's important to say that none of these videos can be independently verified. Journalists are restricted from reporting in much of Syria. What we do know is that the rebels and the government soldiers clashed in Khan Sheikhoun after the explosion. The situation was so volatile that the UN monitors could not leave Khan Sheikhoun. They ended up staying the night in the town. Then today, residents say the monitors were able to negotiate a halt in the fighting and let other monitors come and pick them up. This final video shows the destroyed UN trucks being towed away. Residents say thereafter, the tanks rolled back into town and started shooting again. The UN mission in Syria has been called a unique one. Rather than monitoring the peace, the hope is that it can create the peace. In some parts of Syria, the mere presence of monitors has brought a lull in the violence. But not this week. I think we should ask the monitors to leave, one activist in Khan Sheikhoun told us over Skype. Before they came, the town was bad, he said. Now that they've gone, Khan Sheikhoun is burning. Kelly McEvers, NPR News, Beirut.
Coming up, more conflict between North and South Sudan and trying to restrict the pokies in Australia. This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. The government of South Sudan has accused its neighbor to the north of launching new airstrikes on Southern Territory a charge the North denies. The accusation came only a week after the UN Security Council called on both Sudans to stop fighting and settle their disputes or face possible sanctions. NPR's Fabia Quist-Arkton sent this report from an area of South Sudan which has borne the brunt of the North's cross-border attacks.
Morale-boosting songs keep up the spirits of South Sudan soldiers. They're observing a ceasefire amid a tense calm here in Panaquach, less than 10 miles from the frontier with Sudan in the oil zone. After singing, Private John Nkwedeng says he knows what he's defending.
This is our land.
Yes, it belongs to us.
Southern troops have dug trenches in the black earth at the front line, straddling the oil-producing region. Major General Manga Buong says his men remain on alert and on the defensive in Panaquach. Last month, the South briefly captured the oil-rich town of Hijlich, widely accepted to be in the North. That move triggered the most recent clashes. Southerners claim Hijlich as their own, but pulled out their troops ostensibly because of international pressure. General Buong warns that if dialogue breaks down and Sudanese airstrikes continue, South Sudan will respond with force and claim what he calls its territorial rights, including Hijlich.
We don't want war, but it is our right. It is our right to defend South Sudan.
A bumpy two-hour drive away from the front line in Bentiu, the capital of the South's oil-exporting unity state, survivors are slowly recovering in the hospital from airstrikes by Sudan. The North denies any such aerial bombardments and says the South is backing rebels who are destabilizing Sudan.
Since the beginning of April, we receive, of course, many cases who have got the different injuries. Injury related to dropping of bombs. Yeah, most of them are civilian, if not all are civilian.
Dr. Peter Gatkwoth-Tob, the medical director of Bentiu State Hospital, is treating the patients.
We don't know what is the reason for dropping bombs among the civilian. As a doctor, when I treat this, it's very painful to me.
Sitting up and staring down at her amputated left leg in disbelief, Nyacheng Ngwot-Teni is clearly traumatized. She's 25 and the mother of seven-month-old Dak Tap, a baby boy with a fractured limb. Ngwot-Teni describes hearing a plane and seven loud booms, bombs being dropped. The eighth she didn't hear. It landed on her thatched roof hut, blowing her leg away and wounding her son. Next thing, she woke up in the hospital. In the ward next door lies Mohammed Abdirrahman Kili, a 56-year-old trader. He's another casualty from an earlier bombing in April. The doctor says he suffered more than 90% burns when his shop was hit. Most of Kili's black skin has peeled off, leaving a mass of livid pink and yellow. His face, ears, arms and back are still raw. Despite his horrific burns, Kili believes Sudan and South Sudan can live in peace side by side. The young amputee mother says it's in God's hands whether her infant son grows up in peace. Ofebia Quist-Arkton, NPR News, Panaquach, South Sudan.
In Australia, most gambling is done on coin-operated poker machines. These pokies, as they're called, provide important revenue to many sports and social clubs in a country where gambling restrictions are lighter than they are here. But NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports that concern about addiction and the government's slim majority in Parliament have made the regulation of pokies a hot political issue.
It's a weekday night at the Welcome Stranger pub in downtown Melbourne.
Tom Cummings, who used to be a regular here, shows me around the gaming room.
This machine here, which is called Shaman's Magic, it has four different jackpots that you can win. If you'd like to give it a whirl, you can see how you go.
All right, in goes the dollar coin. The machines here take $50 bills. You can lose $1,200 in an hour, and a win on a pokey is not always what it appears to be. That was a win?
That was a win of 20 cents, but it cost you 50 cents to win it. It's what the industry calls a loss disguised as a win. It sounds like a win, the symbols flash on the screen, but you've actually lost money.
The reason Cummings is explaining and not playing is that in 1995, at age 24, he got hooked on pokies. His habit cost him hundreds of dollars a day. After 3 years, he was broke and $30,000 in debt. He fooled himself into thinking he could beat the machines and win it back, he says, and he deceived those around him to conceal his addiction.
I was addicted to playing poker machines, but I was also trapped in a lie that I couldn't get out of without exposing what I was doing. So the lie just kept on building and building. I became so good at lying that it would actually scare me at how easily I was able to just rattle off something.
Cummings' facade collapsed one evening when his fiancée went to a cash machine and found the bank account was empty.
And she came to me and said, "Where is the money?" And for the first time in years, I couldn't think of a single explanation I could give her that would actually satisfy the question. And then I just had to say, "I'm sorry, but I've spent it all on poker machines." And she broke down. She was horrified because she had no idea.
Australians spend an estimated $13 billion a year on poker machines in pubs, clubs, hotels, and casinos. Richard Evans is executive director of Clubs Victoria, which represents the state's not-for-profit clubs. He says gambling is a matter of personal choice, which the government should stay out of.
If someone's spending tens of thousands of dollars a night, they're either out of control or they want to spend tens of thousands of dollars a night. Who are we to stop someone who wants to spend tens of thousands of dollars a night on gambling? It's not my form of recreation, but it might be someone else's.
Besides, he says, gambling is part of Australia's culture.
The old adage of betting on two flies crawling up the wall who would get to the top first is a cliche, but it's quite true about Australians. They like to have a bet.
Last year, Prime Minister Julia Gillard promised that in future, poker machine players would have to set a daily limit on how much they were prepared to lose. Her real aim, critics say, was to cut a deal with an anti-gambling lawmaker whose backing would give her a majority in Australia's hung parliament. But the clubs threatened a campaign against anti-gambling MPs, and Gillard retreated, calling only for voluntary daily limits and pushing the reforms back 2 years. Dr. Charles Livingston, an expert on gambling and public health at Melbourne's Monash University, voices his frustration.
As one of the commentators said, it looks like the poker machine lobby in Australia is more powerful than the government. And I have to say, it's pretty hard to disagree with that view.
Livingston quotes research showing that 40% of the money put into the pokies comes from problem gamblers. He accuses the pokies industry of preying on society's most vulnerable members, wiping out traditional businesses, and imposing a sterile monoculture on Australian suburbia.
Australian cities are ringed with suburb after suburb, all of which have been built in the last few years. Lots of people, not much to do, and those are the places which are the true face of poker machine gambling in Australia.
Livingston cites survey findings that 70% of Australians feel that pokey gambling is out of control and want more regulation. Meanwhile, the balance of power in Parliament is shifting. So now the Prime Minister may be looking again at cutting a deal with anti-gambling lawmakers. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Canberra.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.